I want to welcome Rabbi Eitan Aviner, who is teaching ahead of Jewish Studies at Or Chaim B'nai Akiva Schools here in Toronto. He is smicha from Yeshiva University, and he's also a Rabbi Ir, a higher level of smicha in Israel. He's a graduate of Machon Lev in Israel, a degree in science, and does a lot of teaching here in Toronto, and it's a pleasure to welcome him and wish him good wishes, all good things. And Bakasha, it's all yours.
Okay, welcome everybody. Everybody see my screen?
Not quite, but now we do.
Now, okay, excellent. So I remember when I was a kid, my family, we used to, on the summers, like many, we used to go on lots of road trips all across America. I was living in New Jersey at the time. One summer we went cross country to California. We went up to the northern coast of Maine down to Florida. And I remember very distinctly one trip we took to the Washington, D.C. It was Washington, D.C. And Philadelphia trip. It was a wonderful trip. And I remember standing in Philadelphia, and we were outside of the Liberty Bell. We were watching the Liberty Bell, and I got a lot of pride, because when you look at the Liberty Bell, as all Americans know, it says on it in big letters, it's in engraved, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." And it brought me a lot of pride as a kid at looking at this bell, this symbol of freedom for America, that they chose to take a pasuk from the Torah to go ahead and represent that. For America to go ahead and take and to base all their ideals on a pasuk from our Bible, I was thrilled, and it brought a lot of pride. The problem is there's the dot dot dot, and there's a lot more after that. You might think just from this pasuk that Judaism is all about liberties, and we were a nation of slaves that were taken out and made free, and therefore Judaism would be very much against the whole institution of slavery. But the problem is that's not the case. And this is pasuk is really only half the story. So I wanted to really touch upon the sensitive topic and kind of paint the whole picture together, and see, well, where really the issue is, and try to digest it with our sense of modern sensibility. So just to kind of frame where the picture is, there are different types of slaves. We could break them up in two or three categories. And there's the Eved Ivri. The Eved Ivri is a Jewish slave, a person who, as the Rambam writes, he delineates all the halachos of the Eved Ivri. And Eved Ivri is actually not so bad. Especially in 2020 with the crash of economy, it might be a good option for many people. It's talking about a person who basically has lost everything. He doesn't have anything left to him, and he wants to go ahead, and so he basically sells himself through Beit Din. Now, the sale is done. It's done in an honorable way. It's done in modesty. It's done b'tzniut, derech kavod. So we don't make a whole like an embarrassing scene out of this. And even as an Eved, it's really not that bad at all. He's treated quite nicely. His master has to go ahead and has to buy him food and clothing. Not only him, but even his wife and children. He takes care of him. And he's really not allowed to work. He's not allowed to work hard or demeanial work. So that's pretty good. That's pretty good. We know the famous halacha that if the master has, there's only one piece of steak left, whatever it is, and it goes to the master or the servant. So the halacha is it goes to the servant. So that sounds pretty good. Sounds like a pretty good deal. And not only that, in the end he gets freed after 7 years, or the Yovel year comes, the Eved Ivri is freed. And he's left with a severance package. The master has to go ahead and send him off with a nice package to help him go on. The Hebrew slave cannot take his wife and kids with him when he gets free. Um, as long as they're not the masters. Okay, we'll come back to that. Point here being that the Eved Ivri is not a bad, it's not a bad deal. It's not a bad deal at all. And if you look at it in the context of where the Eved came from, this is kind of almost like a chesed. Right? This is a rehabilitation process that the Torah instituted for the economic system that they had back in the day, for a man who basically has lost everything. And this is an opportunity for him to get back onto his feet, on his way. And he's kind of supported in a sense by his master. And obviously he has to go ahead and serve the master, but it's only within a certain context of work. So maybe for you it's different, but for me, Eved Ivri doesn't bother me in terms of moral or ethical institution. And I'm a Ivri, a maidservant. I'm a father, Baruch Hashem, of five girls. So the halacha is that you a father can sell his daughter as a maidservant. But you might think that, how does that make any sense in terms of ethics? But the truth is, it's not actually that bad. And luckily, my wife is not online, but I'll explain. We're talking about a father who, kind of the same situation as an Eved Ivri, he doesn't have anything. As the Rambam delineates, we're talking about Ha'ani v'loni shar lo kulum. He doesn't have anything. He can't support his family. He can't provide her with a very good life. So he goes ahead and he sells her into this family. And she's there basically until either Yovel, 7 years pass, or she becomes a bat mitzvah. She becomes of years or brings simanim. And what's interesting is the whole idea afterwards is that the master, either he marries her or he marries her off to his son. But if neither of those happen, she goes free. But even more than that, let's say the master goes ahead and says, all right, I'm going to marry you to my son. I think it's a good shidduch. So he doesn't have to give kesef kedushin. He doesn't have to give her anything. The money that the father received already at the beginning when she was bought, that's considered as the kesef kedushin, which is an amazing thing. Meaning, amai v'ri'ah, the whole young maidservant, it was a process of getting her from her house in terms in a situation where she wasn't a very good road to go on in terms of not having any support. Her father was very poor. So now marrying her off into a family in which she would be much better, not as a maidservant, but eventually as a daughter-in-law. And therefore there's no extra kedushin. And in fact, if, as the Rambam writes, if the husband, so if the master was not somebody who could marry her, or had a son who could marry her, then she's not even allowed to be sold as an Amah Ivri'ah to this family. Which means this whole context is to bring this young lady into a better life, one that she couldn't have had before. So again, even as a father of five daughters, this doesn't bother me so much on a modern sensibility. It makes sense in terms of the life they live. The part that makes me uncomfortable, and I think makes many uncomfortable, is when you get to Eved Kenani. Eved Kenani is not the case of what we spoke about of will there be the Liberty Bell, where we're going to talk about freedom through all the lands when Yovel comes. That's not for the Eved Kenani. Eved Kenani is a non-Jewish slave who was bought by a Jew, and the halachot of an Eved Kenani are very, very different than that of an Eved Ivri. For starters, the Eved Kenani doesn't go free, right? He's an Eved forever. And there are certain circumstances where he will be go free, which we'll talk about, but basically he's an Eved forever. Not only that, there's a in this week's parsha, we just go back up to the pasuk, there's an Isser to free him, right? It's a li'olam behem to avodu. You have, it's a mitzvah aseh, not an Isser to go ahead and free him, but it's a mitzvah aseh to go ahead and have him work for you forever. Okay? That's number one. Number two, you're allowed to give him demeanial work. You're allowed to give him work that's embarrassing. You're allowed to go ahead and make him, if you want to go ahead and make him carry a stone from one side of the field to the other side of the field, back and forth all day long, which has absolutely no toilet, no production to it. You're allowed to do that with an Eved Kenani. You're not allowed to do that with an Eved Ivri. All right. You're allowed to go ahead and give him a demeanial work to clean out the outhouse or whatever it is. But for an Eved Ivri, you're not allowed to do that. And as somebody from, you know, we live in the year 2020, maybe the most difficult is that you're allowed to really abuse him physically to a certain level. You're allowed to hit him. You're allowed to discipline. So what is that all about? What is that all about? How do we make sense of that? If we would hope that if slavery is an institution that we're against in modern times, how could the Torah go ahead and support such an institution? So there are many approaches that are taken, and we're going to go through some of them. What I find very interesting is that really not until like basically the emancipation was any way out of this, or it's, I would say, towards apologetics or understanding the institution of slavery differently. Now, for instance, if you look at the Sefer HaChinuch, the way that he explains the mitzvah, let's jump to the second paragraph. Zechonam levracha binyan eved kenani shemetababa adonav ad shana. So first of all, he works under his master for a year. Im rotzelach for avodah zara, if he goes ahead and he rejects avodah zara, so then you can go ahead and you can give him mila and tfila, and basically there's a giur conversion for the sake of being an eved kenani, and then he's obligated in mitzvos to a lower level than a regular man, to a level of women, Jewish women. And if not, if he doesn't want to go ahead and accept the mitzvos, if he doesn't want to go ahead and reject the avodah zarah, asur lanu lishta'atam bebeitenu, you can't keep him in your house. You can't keep somebody who worships idols in your house more than this 12-month period. And therefore, you have to go ahead and basically sell him, get rid of him. On the mitzvah, lavod behem le'olam, to go ahead and keep them as slaves forever, so Sefer HaChinuch explains, that's on the Eved that you're keeping, right? The one that went ahead and got rid of Avodah Zarah. Now Sefer HaChinuch, he delineates all, basically, the parameters of the mitzvah, and then, very nicely, he goes ahead and he gives you Mishar Shei HaMitzvah, the root of the mitzvah, the reason, Ta'amei HaMitzvah, which are always very nice. So he writes as such, U'Mishar Shei HaMitzvah, L'fi Sha'am Yisrael Heim Nivchar HaMin HaNoshi, V'nir'u LaHakir Baram LaAvod LeFanav. Because Am Yisrael, it's a little hard to swallow, but we are the chosenest of the species, of all of humanity. And to go ahead and to recognize our Creator. It's a little bit of elitist, but that's what the Sefer HaChinuch is saying. And it's appropriate for this elitist group to go ahead and have servants. And if they don't have these servants, I'll call upon him, Mr. Chulish Ta'abed Ba'acheihem. If they don't have servants from the other nations, so then they're going to have to have servants from their brothers, and then their brothers, who are now busy being servants and doing all of this hard work, they won't be able to go ahead and do their avodas Hashem. Therefore, once we rid them of the avodah zarah, it's a mitzvah to keep them, in order that we have somebody to do the work that other the Jews shouldn't be able to have to go ahead and do. And he says this even clearer in the last paragraph. The fundamental reason for the mitzvah is that there should be more people doing avodas Hashem, and because that's the reason of the mitzvah, hayitzu chachamim zichronam livracha la'avor mitzvah zu b'chol eit shivatam mitzvah zu yeh gorem mitzvah acher. Therefore, since there's a mitzvah to go ahead and keep the eved kenani working, if freeing him is going to allow you to go ahead and do another mitzvah, so then you're allowed to go ahead and do it, because it's all for the same reason. To go ahead and increase avodat Hashem in the world, even for a mitzvah derabbanan, he says, a mitzvah derabim. Ki mipnei sheyisod mitzvah eino ela kedei larbot avodato baruch hu, because the fundamental reason of the mitzvah again is to increase avodat Hashem. So says the Sefer HaChinuch, that's what this is about. Somebody's going to have to do the dirty work, And we'd rather, says the Sefer Chinuch, it be the non-Jews, the slaves of the non-Jews versus the Jews, because the Jews have to go ahead and serve Hashem. Lo na'im. Lo na'im in 2020, but that's what the Sefer Chinuch says. And that was comfortable. That was a comfortable thing to say in the days of the Rishonim, even, you know, 150 years ago. I don't think people would have a problem digesting that. In fact, he brings the Midrash. The Midrash could be read in many different ways. The way that he's reading it, we'll see a different way in a little bit. Since you told us we're not allowed to go ahead and work our Jews, our friend, our Jews, our neighbors, our brothers, this hard, who's going to do all this work for me, this hard work? You're allowed to go ahead and take servants from the non-Jews, and they'll do the work for you, which seems to be a support to everything that the Sefer Ochinuch says. But as we commented, we'll see another explanation of that in a bit. Having said that, even though it's permissible for to go ahead and work the Eved Kanani, the non-Jewish slave, for meaningless work and even to afflict him, the Rambam writes, "Mutar la avod be'eved Knani b'farach v'afa pisha din kach midut chasidut v'darkei chachma shi'adam rachman v'rodev tzedek." Even though it's permissible, that's the letter of the law, the appropriate thing, says the Rambam, would really to be above, to really treat him with mercy and righteousness. And he goes on and delineates exactly how he thinks the appropriate way should be. So what do we do with this? How do we make sense of this? Is this something that we just kind of ignore and hope that we don't get into a discussion with Joe on the plane about when he asks us about what Jews think about slavery? Or is there some type of way to kind of bring this on top and match our modern sensibilities? So together, I wanted to go through some of the different approaches. I put I usually don't do this, although I know it's a good idea. But I put here the dates of when they lived, of the different answers, because I think it's interesting to watch how there's a development in terms of thought of how to digest this whole sugya. And really, as I mentioned already before, only at the time from the emancipation onwards, where there is now common rights amongst humanity to a certain extent. Obviously, it didn't all happen at the same time in the same places, but only then do we start to see the Achronim give a different type of flavor to explanation to this sugya. So the first approach I wanted to look at is that of Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch lived in the 19th century, right during the emancipation, and in Germany, and he was very much for the emancipation. As he writes, I'll read it in English, it doesn't matter, English, Hebrew, he wrote it in German. I rejoice when I perceive that this is the concession of emancipation regarding for the inborn right of men to live as equals among equals. And the principle is that whoever bears the seal of a child of God and to whom belongs the earth shall be willingly acknowledged by all as brother. Rav Hirsch was very much for the emancipation. This is great. This is wonderful. This is the development of humanity. This is what the Torah wants, that we're all treated as having zechuyot adam, betzalem elokim. So then what do you do with Eved Kanani? What do you do with slavery? Rav Hirsch has to deal with that. Rav Hirsch says like this: "V'chol eved ish maknet kesef. Mikan shatora minicha ki gam be'et sheze ata yatzam me'avdut lecherut yamshich litkayem kinyan guf b'avdim sheniknu b'chutz la'aretz." The Rav Hirsch, I mean, background to where Rav Hirsch is coming from. This is in Shemot, where we were just freed from Egypt. Right? We were just taken out. So, what would you think one of like the first laws should be about coming out of Egypt? Right? I don't know. It could be a lot of stuff. What I wouldn't want on a list is to tell me the halachas of slaves. Like, that's the last thing I want to hear coming out. They are telling me how I treat slaves. I was just a slave. You're telling me now that we're acknowledging the whole institution, right? Let my people go in order that they should have other people for themselves and work for them. How does that make any sense? That's what Rav Hirsch is dealing with. How is it you can have ownership? You can treat a person like an object, against his will, selling him or using him as you please. L'shem havana Havanat Avodah Zu, Suma Aleinu, La'ayin B'tanei Araka. So Rav Hirsch says, we have to go ahead. If you want to understand really the sugya, you have to understand some background. Yehudi lo yechol haya la'afoch adam la'eved. There's no such way that a Jew can go ahead and make somebody into an Eved. That's not what we're talking about. Eved Kanani is not taking somebody, going out to the street, chaining him, and making him your Eved. Rak b'nei adam shayu avadim behet em l'mishpat ha'amim ha'mukubal, otam yechol haya la'afoch l'rechusho ayedei k'niyatam. You went to the market, and you bought an Eved from somebody else. This person was already an Eved with the non-Jews, and you purchased it from him. I didn't make him, I didn't turn him into an Eved, he was already an Eved. Still, Ulam ha'avarato l'rechush Yehudi, hayta hatzalato ayechida shel adam. To go ahead and make him from property, rechush, uses the word, to make him from the property of the non-Jews, to bring him to the property of a Jew, you're saving him. You're literally saving him. Asher choka amim ha'mukubal ha'tvi'i alav, avdut. They didn't treat him nicely. The attitude or relationship from master to Eved was awful. Talking about there was a marriage, there was a revolt in Jamaica, where the slaves were freed, they were given rights, but they weren't really given rights. They weren't treated that way. There was still this relationship, this way that I'm going to behave towards you, that continued as master slave even after slavery was gone. So all his the present history that he's talking about, ma umlau mufkar hu aved ben shenishlu zechiyotav al yedei mishpat ha'amim ha'mukubal ben shezachar l'shevion zechiyot avadayim mekirim oto b'chol makom ke'eved o k'mi shehaya eved. Even if you go ahead and you free him, he's still an eved amongst. The way that he's viewed in society is still an Eved, and that's how he's going to be treated. We don't have to go just look what was happening in America from the time of the Civil War until the 60s, 70s. There wasn't an equality. However, says Rav Hirsch, Beit HaYudi haya lo l'niklat. Sham hagen alav hachok mipnei et alalut. Being an Eved in the house of a Jew, even as an Eved Kanani, was saving him. It was a miklat. It was an ear miklat for him, in a sense. And that's a good thing. When you compare it, right, it's all about perspective. If you compare it to how a free person is, or how an Eved Ivri is, okay, it's not so good. But he compared to what he had before, you compare what their options were, so this is an amazing thing. This is the approach of Rav Hirsch. Rav Uziel, the first Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, takes a similar approach. Not just in terms of how people treat them, of kind of social norms, but physically. He writes in the end, even at the beginning, he writes, he makes the same point that they were sold into slavery already. Right? You weren't making someone into a slave. And he writes like this. I mean, Alpha Pekin, even though a person becomes a slave, lo huter lishlot begufam, you didn't have permissibility to go ahead and do whatever you want physically to the Eved Kanani. And lafidu impagu behem be'echad marashei avarim, you went ahead and you damaged one of his major limbs, Adam, Evedu yotzei lecherut. You had no permissibility to go ahead and knock out his eye, knock out his teeth, to harm him in some type of physical way like that. And if you did, you abused your right, and he goes free. You couldn't go ahead and hit him however you want with any implements. You couldn't hit him with a piece of metal, rather only with a stick or a ritsua or some type of whip. Right? There were certain parameters of what was allowed and what was not. Let's skip down. And if you did hurt him in the wrong way and inappropriately, you'd have to pay for that monetarily. This was to go ahead and buy the Torah by instituting, by acknowledging the institution of Eved Kanani was saving him from being beaten to death in the hands of his non-Jewish slave owner. There were restrictions here, and it was hefker in the world of the non-Jews of, as being slaves. The only reason was to go ahead, instituting slavery, acknowledging it, was to go ahead and save him from the brutal realities of what it meant to be a slave amongst the non-Jews. Says Rav Uziel. That's one approach. It kind of became a physical ir miklat to save the Eved. And then Nitziv takes I'll take questions a little towards the end. We'll have time. The Nitziv takes a similar approach, but he views it as not as an opportunity as an ir miklat gufani, of a physical ir miklat, but that of ruchani, of saving the Eved Knani spiritually. Because as he was by the non-Jews, the assumption was, is Ovid of Adazara, idolatry, and whatnot. But once he comes into the ownership of the Jew, so now he has an obligation to go ahead and let go of all the Avodah Zarah. So you're saving him spiritually. But not only that, that also explains, says the Nitziv, once he's already been in your house, he's been there for 12 months, he says, okay, no more Avodah Zarah. And then now he's there for 5 years, 10 years. The reason, says the Nitziv, you're not allowed to let him go is because he's already tasted so much of what it means to have Torah. He's been obligated in a certain level of mitzvot. He's been in your house. He's been at your Shabbos table. Now you're going to free him, and what's going to happen? He's going to go back to where he came from? He's going to go back to a life of Avodah Zarah? So the Torah says you're not allowed to let him go. You're not allowed to return to the life that he was in. You have him in this ir miklat ruchani. Don't let him go. Not because we want you to abuse him, because we want you to save him. Okay, those are nice ideas from Rav Hirsch, Rav Uziel, and the Nitziv. Moving on to Rav Kook. Rav Kook was an interesting thinker in many ways. Just preface with a interesting statement of Rav Kook. Rav Kook in source number 12, he writes, Harbe deot kozvot. There are a lot of ideals and philosophies going around there, and a lot of them aren't good. Hamashutot ba'olam amavirot rabim al datam ve'al dat konam. Lo bo ki'im misibat ha'shifa ha'nifraza shelo teda eit v'zman l'kol chefetz ve'ein la ma'atzor ve'guvo. Rav Kook says, everything has to be in the proper time and in the proper way. Whenever you take an ideal, which might even have a true source, it might be correct, but it's implemented in the wrong time, in the wrong way, or to the wrong extreme, then it becomes bad, it becomes evil. We won't get into it now, but see Rav Kook's famous letter on vegetarianism, where he speaks about there's a time and a place for it and the reason for it, but not for now. So what does Rav Kook say about this? Unfortunately, they don't have this on Bar Ilan, so we have the actual copy here. Rav Kook, 1865, 1935, just to put us into perspective. Rav Kook says like this, V'da'od, sha'avdut kamo kol dorche Hashem yesharim, sh'tadkinim yolchu bam, v'poshim yachshulu bam. Anything the Torah delineates for us are rules, they are the right ways. We don't need apologetics. There's truth to it. These are ideals. Don't think that it's going to bring any detriment to the world. These are how it's supposed to be. Heavy sentence from Rav Kook, but the law of slavery, the institution of slavery, this is natural. Slavery is natural within humanity. What does he mean? There's no difference between what's a legislated slavery versus what natural slavery.
He
You go ahead and you, in the Torah, institutionalizes properly slavery, so it's going to go ahead and it's going to fix many detrimental things that would have been without it. Sha'avdut ha'tavit hit sipuya aleihem. It's going to be, there was going to be slavery anyways. What does he mean? Lemashal, hara mitziut shel aniyim v'ashirim chalashim v'gvorim, davar mukhraf v'nog. It's reality. There are poor people. There are rich people. There are middle class people. Right? There is social stratification. There's breaks in the class. That's just the way it's going to be. We're not communists. Imkain otam shekanu lahem nechasim merubim. Those who have lots of estate, lots of property. Sheheim mishtamshim bekoach hamishpat l'schor ovdim aniyim lavototam. So the rich people are going to go ahead and they're going to hire the less rich people to go ahead and work for them. You're going to have an inequality in the workforce. That's just the way that it's going to be in any type of economy that is not socialist. Those, heavy sentence, but those who are working on the bottom of the chain, Rav Kook says that there is some type of nature of this to them. Society has put them that way and made them by their nature into that. Those who work in the coal mines, they're doing it by themselves. They're it's voluntary work. They're getting paid. But in a sense, the way it was in Rav Kook's time is when you worked in the coal mines, you were an eved to the person who owned the coal mines. Rav Kook says, imagine this, using the example of people who work in the coal mines. If they weren't free people, but they were slaves, they would be much better off. How so? What about their freedoms? Says Rav Kook, למשל, עכשיו אנחנו צריכים להראות מוסריות לדאוג בעד חיי העבדים. If you're a master on the Eved, so you have responsibilities to him, right? You have responsibilities to his life. Food, you got to take care of him. It's not just, oh, if my, you know, my worker doesn't come into work today, or I fire him, I'll get somebody else. חומרי והמוסרי והעשיר שליבו אטום לועג לכל צדק ומוסר, ויותר נוח לו שבנרא יחסר אור ואוויר. If he's worrying, if he's treating his worker, which is an Eved, like rechosh, he's treating him like property, so he's going to treat him like his property, he's going to take care of it. He's going to make sure there's going to be better conditions in the mine coals, right? There's going to be better lighting, there's going to be better support, so it doesn't cave in, there's going to be better ventilation. All of this, Rav Kook says, is because the Ashir, the guy who owns the mine coals, is going to take care of his rechush. But it's only his rechush if he's an Eved. But if he's a free man just coming and working 9 to 5, and then he's going home, and if he dies in a mine collapse, then what? Does the rich man care? No, he doesn't care. There'll be another one tomorrow. Easy come, easy go. But if he's an Eved, says Rav Kook, he's going to be taken care of. So in short, we're not going to read this all. In short, Rav Kook says that because there is a divide within the social economic system, there will always be people on top and there will always be people on bottom. If the people on the bottom are treated as property, not in a negative way, there's a positive aspect to that as well, then they'll be taken care of as property is taken care of. And that has a lot of benefits. And therefore, Rav Kook explains that slavery really isn't ideal in certain social norms. Okay. Okay. Here we get to the, in my opinion, the more interesting answers, which really press the buttons on a lot of sugyas. So I want to spend a little more time discussing the last two and their ramifications. Rav Nachum Rabinovich, many of you know, just recently passed away. A giant and a pioneer. I was privileged to learn at Ma'alei Dumim under him for 3 months. But more, what I got from him was from his students and from the Beit Midrash that he built. He had a very a very clear path in terms of his philosophy and his derech limud, and that becomes clear also in his writings here. Rabbi Rabinovich, for those who don't know, is he's a Rambam man through and through, through halacha, machshava, a rationalist, and we see that screaming in his writings here. So in his Ma'amar Darkosha Torah, his article, he writes like this. We'll make a lot of references to what he's saying to the philosophy of the Rambam as well. Ma'arachat HaTorah HaMitzvah HiKfula. The whole system, says Rav Rabinovich, that the Torah gives to us for mitzvot is really twofold. There are two aspects to all mitzvot. Mitzad achad, Hiknit deot v'asharet arachim nitzchiim v'anchaya la'avodat Hashem b'darkah ha'gvoah biyoter v'yitzuv chevra ruya liyot merkava l'shchina. The first realm is that of instilling in us proper values, proper philosophies, which are eternal. And not something which is going to change over time and that made sense or that was appropriate for whatever it was 2,000 years ago, but these are eternal philosophies. And these are eternal systems to create a society which is going to go ahead and allow and encourage for these philosophies to come to light. I'll give examples to what he means. Umi'idach, chakika v'tzivuim litmodeid im kochot hara'a v'haris ha'mitpartzim b'nafsho shel ha'yachid v'aruchot shel ha'am להבטיח קיום תנאים הכרחים להתפתחות רוחנית ברמה אפשרית במציאות הקיימת בכל דור ודור, לפי הנסיבות החברתיות, הכלכליות וההתרבותיות השוררות באותו זמן, באותו מקום. On the other hand, we have laws which are necessary to, so to speak, deal with the negative impact of certain things in society or certain things within a human being. And that is based on the time and the place. But they aren't necessarily ideals. They're more of a protocol to deal with a situation. For example, tefillin, kriyat shema, accepting the yoke of heaven, of Hashem's unity, all of these are ideals that are eternal. And when we do mitzvot that have to do with these, it's to get us to that philosophy, get us that to that knowledge, that way of thinking, and that's eternal. That was the same in time with Moshe Rabbeinu as it is today. In the same light, you'll have certain laws in the Torah which are, I would say, they are preparatory in order for you to be able to do that. For instance, the Rambam explains in Mor Nevuchim, basically most of social laws are to create an environment, a society, which a person can sit and philosophize and get to these ideas. Why is it prohibited to kill? Why shouldn't you kill? On a basic level, you can bring nice ideals, but the Rambam simply says, listen, if a person can go ahead and kill somebody, so you're not going to be able to sit and philosophize if every second you have to look behind your back, maybe my neighbor's going to come and kill me. I need to be free to think about these great ideas, to think about God, to connect to God. And I can't do that if I always have to watch my back. Why do I have to give tzedakah? Because one day I might need tzedakah. So to make the world go round, to make society functional, and society needs to be functional in order that I can go ahead and get to this high level of Avodas Hashem, of dat, of the mind, that's what we need. That's group one. Group number two, says Rav Rabinovich, is you need certain things because, well, that's just the situation. He gives me three examples, so I'm going to actually push that off for a second until we finish the paragraph, and I'll tell you about the examples. L'matara rishona ma'amida lefaneinu ha'torah edim iluim ha'mishamshim etgor v'tamritz ledorot rabim v'afil b'nei aliyah lo yasigam b'shleimut. In the first category, it's an endless marathon. It's not something that a person may ever get to. But in every generation, every person through every stage in his life, he has to go ahead and he has to work and to get to these high levels. Okay. So what are the examples that he gives in the second case? The three examples that he gives, we're just going to speak about the second one, but it's important to mention all three. Is example number one is divorce. Divorce and many wives. Those are the examples, the first examples. It puts them in one category. You know, we say, I wish I can fulfill all 613 mitzvahs. I don't think anybody actually, believes that. I don't think anybody actually wants, first of all, it's not possible. But second of all, even if it was, nobody wants that. Nobody's running around and saying, wow, I need to get married today so I can divorce my wife tomorrow and nikayim the mitzvah. Nobody's saying, you know, lo aleinu, I hope my brother dies so I could do yibum. These aren't things that we hope. These are unfortunate circumstances in which we now have to deal with the situation. And the Torah gives us a way to deal with them. But divorce isn't an ideal. It's to deal with a situation. Yibum is not an ideal. It's to deal with a situation, an unfortunate circumstance. Says Rav Rabinovich, many wives is not an ideal either, right? They're called sroroth. They're called troublemakers for each other. It's not a very good way for a house to function. Example number three, we're going to skip number two because that's slavery. Example number three, he says, is war. We are not a bloodthirst nation. The Torah is not a bloodthirst book, although certain parts do seem that way. But nobody wants war, right? The Torah is for shalom, it's for tzedek, it's for mishpat. But under certain circumstances, war becomes a necessity. It's not an ideal, it's a necessity. And the laws, the halachot of war, are to go ahead and to give us protocol to deal with that situation. So what about slavery? Rabinovich says slavery is the same. Dugma shnia, lefichach nevra adam yechidi ba'olam. Why was man created as an individual? Kach mebereishit l'tenu Torah shema'amandan shel kol bnei adam shaveh be'emet. Everyone is created equal. Man was created as an individual. We are all equal in our essence, in terms of our value. Ella, rather, what happens? Shel kolu et ma'aseihem v'sheibdu ish mechavero v'efridu b'nei adam bein avadim l'mashlam ba. The way that society ended up developing is that there, in a social economic system, people are not equal. Not in terms of their value, but in terms of how we treat each other. That there are people up high and there are people on low. These aren't essential. These aren't about the essence of a person. It's not real on an ontological level. We're all equal in the eyes of God. Nonetheless, the Torah acknowledges that we're all equal, yet goes ahead and allows for the institution where we treat each other like objects. But if I'm treating you as an object and me as the owner, how am I treating you as, how is that equality? This is the fundamental yisod that Rabbeinu, the Rambam, explained. Might get in trouble for this one. The Rambam says, Machmat chashash, mash'ein yecholet lenefesh lekablo kefi ha'teva. Because God was concerned that maybe a person, a person is not going to be able to, by his nature, not going to be able to accept something. Hasev Hashem otam min haderech hayeshara shi'aita hamatara rishona. Hashem wanted you to be over here. He knows that you're not going to get there, so he's making you go this way in order to get there. Right? The example the Rambam is talking about is actually a avodah zarah. And karbanos and sacrifices. Hashem doesn't want us, says the Rambam, and he got into a lot of trouble for this, burned his books and whatnot. Says the Rambam, why do we have animal sacrifices? That seems so archaic, so barbaric, so not in the line of this philosophical Torah that we've been giving. Says the Rambam, listen, look, they just had a nation come out of Egypt. They were slaves. They were entrenched in this environment of idolatry and sacrifices. You're going to tell me you're going to take them out now from Egypt and tell them these nice big philosophical ideals and don't sacrifice any animals? Shalom al Yisrael? They're not going to accept that, right? They wanted their avatiach and they wanted to go back to Egypt just for watermelon and cucumbers. Avodah Zarah? So says the Rambam, Hashem had to go ahead and he had to funnel that desire that they could not let go into Judaism somehow. I had to go ahead and say, listen, you want animal sacrifices? I'll give you animal sacrifices. But we're going to limit it as much as possible. It's only going to be certain types of animals. It's only going to be certain places in the Beit HaMikdash. Only going to be done by certain people. Kohanim have to be involved. And it's only going to be with at certain times. So we've narrowed this down into a way which it's controlled. So Rav Rabinovich takes that idea and now he applies it to slavery. Mipnei korach ha-metziyut v'yitra ha-Torah al yisumo ha-malei shel ikaron miyad. Ideally, the Torah would prefer there is no such thing as owner-slave being treated as object. But that wasn't going to happen. The Torah had to go ahead and mivater on that ideal. How so? We're going to go ahead and we're going to give the ability for society to develop and evolve little by little to get to the place where Hashem wanted him to be in the first place. Until they get to that full understanding. Now he brings the midrash that we brought for the Sefer HaChinuch. Watch how he brings it. Shema tamru b'man nishtamesh, lest you say, well, if I can't go ahead and use my neighbor, my brother as a slave, what am I supposed to do? Talmud lomar v'avdacha v'amatecha asher yu l'cha me'et ha-goyim. You should go ahead and use your non-Jewish neighbors, your non-Jewish slaves. Watch out what he does with this. Ba'olam ha'atik, k'mach lo'ayta efsharud l'kayem mesek takin b'li koach adam rav. Back in the old days of economics, you could not have any type of functional economy without slaves. It just didn't work. You needed slaves. You needed manpower. Manpower came from slaves. U'b'derech klo oto koach adam gvi'as l'rov b'na avadim. It came from slaves. U'b'china kakalit b'lti efshari ha'ya hadavar. You could not find another way to find workers. It was slaves or that's it. There's no economy. The manish damesh. So what are we going to do? It wasn't a statement of like the Sefer HaChinuch was viewing it as, well, we need slaves. We need someone to do our dirty work. It was a cry. The manish damesh. What are we going to do? You're going to tell us I can't have slaves? How are we going to function? How are we going to live? It should be ritzinit. Haita tana ritzinit. She'ein l'talei mimena. This isn't something you can go ahead and ignore. This is the real. This is a real issue. Berama Torah astam hapecha b'mosad avdut. Even with that being the case, the Torah went ahead and revolutionized the whole institution of slavery. Ad kami kronod yisod iyevshaya levater beim kilu yitzru ritzpa leminoa hitoradudut l'to'am tarbut hara'a shel ha'umot. There's a bottom line threshold. Where the Torah says, you want slaves? I got it. You're going to have slaves. But there's a certain boundary. Like, don't cross that line. You got to treat them a certain way. There's a certain amount of human dignity and respect. Someone's going to have to do the dirty work. Got it. But don't cross that line. That's the approach of Rav Rabinovich, which is basically taking the approach of the Rambam and applying it to a different case. More radical than that is Rabbi Sacks. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, interesting, who he himself, he writes that he actually views Rabbi Rabinovich as one of his three great luminaries, three great Rebbeim that has really guided him in his way of thinking, in his philosophy. So he takes these ideas, he doesn't quote Rabbi Rabinovich, but he takes these ideas and he takes them one step further. One step which for me, to me, is extremely scary. And I'm not sure what to do with it. And maybe when after that, we'll open up and try to figure out how to digest this. Says Rabbi Sacks, this is from 5772, but I think he writes basically the same thing on it every year. You can find any year of Parshas Bahar to find it. Change is possible in human nature, but it takes time. Time on a vast scale, century, even millennia. There's little doubt that in terms of the Torah's value system, the exercise of power by one person over another without their consent is a fundamental assault against human dignity. This is not just true of the relationship between master and slave. It is even true, according to many classic Jewish commentators, of the relationships between king and subjects, rulers and ruled. According to the sages, this is even true of the relationship between God and human beings. The Talmud says that if God really did coerce the Jewish people to accept the Torah by suspending the mountain over their heads, that would constitute an objection to the very terms of the covenant itself. We are God's avadim, servants, only because our ancestors freely chose to be. So slavery is to be abolished. But it is a fundamental principle of God's relationship with us that he does not force us to change faster than we are able to do so on our own free will. So Mishpatim does not abolish slavery, but it set in motion a series of fundamental laws that will lead people, albeit at their own pace, to abolish it on their own accord. If history tells us anything, it is that God has patience, though it is often sorely tried. He wanted slavery abolished, but he wanted it to be done by free human beings coming to see of their own accord the evil it is and the evil it does. The God of history, who taught us to study history, had faith that eventually we would learn the lessons of history. that freedom is indivisible. We must grant freedom to others if we truly seek it for ourselves. Rav Sacks really pushes the boundaries here. What is Rav Sacks, in essence, saying? The Torah, like Rav Rabinovich before him said, the Torah doesn't really like slavery. It's not an ideal of the Torah. The difference between Rabbi Sacks and Rabinovich is Rabinovich says, but there's a practical need. We got to be practical. So we're going to allow this non-ideal in order to have a practical, pragmatic society. Rabbi Sacks says, no, God's really, you know, he's pulling your leg here a little bit. He's telling you slavery was never okay. It was never something that the Torah wants. But it couldn't tell you it didn't want it. It had to let you come to that conclusion on your own. You have to come and to accept and to develop that sense of morality, that sense, that ethical compass to say, you know, this is really wrong. We should stop doing this. So it's nice, and it makes me feel warm inside, and I can go to sleep under my blanket tonight with a hot cocoa, and I can feel good about myself and about the Torah and about society. But I'm going to have nightmares from this. Because where's the line in his logic? What's to stop us from saying, well, yeah, you know, the Torah said that this is an, you know, it allowed for it as an ideal, right? Remember, Rav Kook said, slavery is an ideal. Don't think it's not. We should have slaves. We should treat people as objects, because when you treat people like objects, you treat them with better than they would have been treated otherwise. Rav Sacks is saying it's not an ideal. The Torah wanted you to find out on your own, to kind of, you know, think about it and get to your own conclusion that this is really bad and we should get rid of it. So why stop at slavery? What's the next step? You know, I don't want to get in trouble here, but, you know, Rabbi Kelman's here, so I guess I'm safe, or he'll get in more trouble than I will. But women in Judaism, like, is that homosexuality? Where does this go? Where do we say, yeah, the Torah didn't really mean it, and now that we're more enlightened people, we can come to different conclusions? Now, a clear distinction could be made. Listen, there's a difference between an isser versus just not having a slave, right? Not having a slave in the first place, I'm not over anything, right? Homosexuality or whatnot, well, there's a serum involved. But I'm not getting in there. I'm not doing that right now. I'm just, in terms of our outlook, right? How is our approach in terms of the evolution of ethics, if the Torah is a guidebook which is supposed to guide humanity to a higher level of morality and ethics? So how do we relate to it? What guidelines is Rabbi Sacks really giving us to work with? It's an open question. I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know where Rabbi Sacks would draw the line. But what is interesting is that if you look at the progression of ideas, thoughts here in terms of how to deal with it, starting all the way from before anybody dealt with it, right? Before Rav Hirsch, which was like, yes, slaves, what's the problem? So coming Rav Hirsch and giving legitimacy to it, you go through the generations until you get to Rabbi Sacks, and that's just Rabbi Sacks, you know? He's still mainstream, more or less. I don't know what else is being said or what's going to be said in 10 years, not just about slavery, but about anything. It's a scary issue. I don't know what the answer is, but what I do know is that the sugya of slavery is the opening to this discussion. And with that, I guess we'll open up to, I will stop the share screen. Can I do that? Yeah. And we can open up for questions if anybody's still here.
Question.
Joe, go ahead.
Back yeah, Joe.
What about the Gemara talking about not being allowed to free a slave, so how an Eved Kanani, how do you understand that from this standpoint?
Okay, good. So the Gemara is getting that right from the pasuk Leolam Behem Tavodu. You should go ahead and mitzvah Aseh to go ahead and work them forever. So the different approaches take different routes with that. Right, Rav. The Nitziv says the guy who just spent so many years by your Shabbos table, and now you're going to send him back to his old ways? You can't do that. You have a responsibility to him. Don't let him fall back into his old ways. Right? You just rehabilitated this drug addict and alcoholic, and now you're going to send him back to the streets? Right? To just use an analogy. So it says, don't do that. It's a responsibility. A lot of the earlier approaches, they take slavery as a rehabilitation. It's a service you're doing to the person, whether it's an Eved Ivri or it's an Eved Kanani. It's a chesed. It's a service. You're helping that person now. Not to your benefit. It's his benefit. It's the slave's benefit because he's better off under you. So therefore, don't let him go.
Of course, Rabbi Eitan, if you know the Gemara in Brachos was it Rabbi Gamliel who freed a slave to make a minyan, and the Gemara says for a mitzvah Rabbah, you can free a slave, which if you want to take Rabbi Sachs's sort of philosophical thing, which I think I'm very glad you raised the point. I think there is a lot to say there with Rabbi Sachs, and I think that's in many ways what we do. I don't know how to phrase it, but in a certain sense, as modern Orthodox Jews, we do believe in that in many ways. What are the limits is an excellent question. Like, you know, interest, there are lots of things in the Torah that we've basically done away with because society has changed. And there, I mean, even something as simple as chametz on Pesach is a total against what it says in the Torah. The Torah says, don't have chametz in your house. Every single one of us here, I think, has chametz in their house on Pesach. So yes, I understand. So we have a technicality to get around that. Rabbi Sachs is just putting it in a moral framework and is sort of being, in a sense, more honest about it. It's clear the Torah doesn't like slavery. I mean, that's clear. By Nebuchadnezzar, it's more complex. I agree. And Enoch and Ami views are changing about homosexuality. And I think many of us think that's not a bad thing. We struggle with, how do we reconcile? That's what he's struggling with. How do we reconcile what the Torah says with our modern sensibilities? The answers are not simple. I'm sorry if I'm talking too much. I usually don't like to do that, but you know, if anybody has any comments. But I think you did raise an important question. Since you said you want to get me into trouble, I'll happy to oblige and to get myself into trouble. But I think Rabbi Sachs, really, I think there is a lot there. And you're right. Where he draws the limits, I don't know. And he probably doesn't know. I don't think any of us know. And that's what the great Poskim have done throughout history, but we do. We've gotten rid of interest. We've gotten around a lot of things in the Torah. I don't know if you want to comment on what I say.
Yeah, with certain things, if we know what the for interest, right? So the reason is because don't take advantage of the poor person and use it to your own benefit. I'm giving a reason to it. So if society has now turned on its place and you want to help the poor person by having banks, right? If without interest, you don't have a bank. So you don't have a society. You don't have economy. So therefore, it would be within the spirit of the law to charge interest, to find a way to have interest work.
That's fine, but it never says that in the Torah. I totally agree with that, and I explain it the same way. Our economies have changed, and you can't live without interest, 100%. But none of that is in the Torah. In other words, that's all rabbinic later, and I don't have to, there were rabbinim who were opposed to heteriska and the famous dream of the Vilna Gaon, I forget who, not to use a heteriska ever because it's really against what it says in the Torah. And the heter mechira is also what by Shemitah. I totally get it, but obviously it's this week's Parsha. That's the part of the Parsha you didn't really talk about, you know. Heter mechira obviously is you know, basically against the Torah. We need it, Einachinami, and that's what he's raising. Okay, let other people speak. I'm sorry. Eric, I think you had your hand up. Wanted to say something. I think that's what the hand up, if anybody wants to speak. But Rav Eitan, please feel free to comment or to disagree. And I myself don't know where to draw the limits. Obviously, I don't know. That's clear. But I'm saying it is a fascinating topic.
I was going to ask a question.
Yeah, sure. Please.
Go ahead. I mean, the Torah has, I think it's 36 times, it says, Lo tachatz et hager, or ki gerim hayitem. And, you know, Rashi, I know that, I think in the Gemara, it talks about a ger toshav, a ger tzedek, I guess that converted. But Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi, if you look, I believe it's in Saba, he says it includes a non-Jew. In the prohibition, in the love. So how do you reconcile that with treating a person the way you can treat a Kanani with the Isser of Lo Tichatz?
Treating him like a slave?
Yeah, well, how do you treat a Kanani? You can inflict the punishment. You're treating a slave. I mean, if you did that to a free person, a non-Jew, you'd be overtly the love of Lotichatz. So how do you get away, how does the Torah, how do you philosophize, how do you get around that dichotomy between how you're allowed to treat one person who's a slave and the other person who's not a slave? You can't. It's an issue.
All right. So, you know, we live in a generation. I'm young, but you know, people here is grandparents, and I'm not saying anybody here, but they'll tell me when they were a kid, they got hit with rulers and whatnot. And society was that you discipline people by hitting them.
No, I'll say the Torah tells you not. Torah tells you 36 times, don't do this. So like, I know I got hit enough to it myself. So like,
so I'll share. I have a close relationship with many of my students, Baruch Hashem. And I'm prefacing that for the story. So I had a student. He was being a little out of line in class. He was, you know, very close with the student. So I said to him, please don't get me in trouble for this. I said to him, I look at him, I said, you know, if this was 20 years ago, I would take out a ruler and I would just hit you in the back, right? And he looks at me and he says, you know, if this is 20 years in the future, I'd hit you back, right? And I smiled at him and I said, you know, you're probably right. Like that's where we're going. Society changes. So it's hard for us to imagine what was like that. And I hear what you're saying. I hear there's a difficulty of the Torah doesn't want you to do this in one area, but it's allowing it in another area. And that's really the heart of the sugya, that the Torah seems to paint for us certain ideals. And when those ideals don't fit in with all of the halachot or constructs of the Torah, what do we do, right? The Torah believes in equality, that people are created b'tzelem elokim. So then, how could you take a person and treat him like a rock, like a toaster, like an object?
I'm wondering, can I speak?
Please,
because I'm having a little trouble with the Zoom. You can hear me?
Yeah.
You see me? I'm wondering how much Rabbi Sachs's reaction is to sort of a neo-Karaite approach that, well, it doesn't matter what it says in the Torah is this, and we have to do this. And that's not the way we normally interpret.
I that resonates with me a lot, and I don't know the answer. And that's what's scary about what he's saying. I don't know. It's like the chicken or the egg. I don't have an answer, but I definitely, that's what you're saying definitely resonates with me. What are we putting ahead of what?
I just want to make a comment. The idea of abrogating Torah laws goes back to Hillel in regarding to the Prisbol, and that goes back very far. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, Hillel already change the law that the Torah is very careful to say that debts are to be forgiven in the seventh year, and I will go and after those who don't do that. And Hillel says, no, we're going to undo this law in the Torah. And that's what it is. We have this principle, and the rabbis didn't negate him. And for the same matter, there are many laws where the Torah says you should take the lulav and the estrog on the first day of the holiday, and we decide, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. So we the rabbis have taken upon themselves to change many of the laws in the Torah, either some lenient and some in more strict manners. This is the nature of Judaism.
Rabbi Eitan, you want to say, since we're having a very nice conversation here, I think what you're really touching upon are two concepts we have in rabbinic literature. We have the notion the rabbis can change the law b'shevi al tasa passively. That everybody agrees. Don't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. I mean, they need a good reason. There is an opinion in the Yerushalmi, the Bavli doesn't agree with this, but it quotes this opinion that the rabbis do have the right to yesh koach b'yad chachamim lakor davar b'kum v'aseh. The rabbis can actively uproot a Torah, which means they can say, eat a cheeseburger. If they had a good reason, they could theoretically do this. That's a wild opinion. But if you hold that, that really, you know, puts a whole new perspective. And then you have Eich Lasot Hashem, Heferet Torotecha. We wrote down the Oral Law. Sometimes we don't want to break the law, but we have no choice. In other words, we couldn't live without the Oral Law. So you're right. The rabbis have tremendous power. The question is how to use it. And of course, obviously, the rabbis of today, how does that compare? But you're right. These issues are really of fundamental importance, how we practice our Judaism and what we'll be in 20 years from now is fascinating, correct? But thank you. Rav Eitan, I think we should end soon. I don't want to keep people too long, so I'll let you have the last word, Rav Eitan, of course, and to thank you. And if you want to make a concluding, you know, your comment or so, and then we'll wish everybody a Laila Tov, invite them to come. I give a Pirkei Avot shiur tomorrow at 9:30. If you're around, everybody's welcome, of course. And next week, our whole slate of shiurim. But Rav Eitan, you have the last word, please.
Yeah. If anybody enjoyed the shiur and wants to praise, you can send emails to me. If you have any complaints, send them to Rabbi Kelman, please.
There you go. There you go. Great. That's nice. Okay. And I just want to wish Rav Eitan well. I meant to ask if I could say, I hope I can say, his father recently passed away, right? It's actually of COVID in New York. So I want to wish him on behalf of everybody nechama, and they should be well. You know, it's hard not being able to say Kaddish and everything. It's just when we should have many smachot, we should all be healthy and only celebrate happy occasions all together. And I want to wish everybody Shabbat Shalom and everybody well. Okay.